You are listening to 97.3 LPFM, WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. On today's edition of WRIR's Audio News Digest, we'll talk with Carol Pearsall, the artistic director of the Firehouse Theater Project, about her recent ejection from the theater she helped to found. We'll also speak with Carl Hamm, a.k.a. DJ Carlito, about his new project, Pop Yay. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. On Wednesday, Republican House Speaker William Howe killed his own party's surprise Senate redistricting plan. Last month's legislation, which some critics accused of watering down the black vote and proponents argued was necessary under the Voting Rights Act, came tacked on to an unrelated bill and was an apparent shock to most everyone. Governor Bob McDonnell asserted himself as among the amazed, but did not commit to vetoing this plan, though in 2011 he did veto another redistricting plan and went so far as to call that one gerrymandering. The 2013 attempt at redistricting took place when Senator Henry March III, a longtime civil rights lawyer whose vote would have been pivotal, played hooky to attend the presidential inauguration on Martin Luther King Day. Speaker Howe said in a news release that, while he respects the prerogative of the Senate and its members to deal with issues before that body, the legislation is in violation of House rules and the principles by which he had led over the last 10 years. Virginia Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling may be entering the governor's race as a third-party candidate after all. According to the Associated Press, Bowling told a crowd of political reporters at the Virginia Capitol Correspondents Association dinner on Wednesday night that they should mark their calendars for March 14th for a major announcement. Bowling's quest for the GOP gubernatorial nomination was thwarted last fall when state Republicans adopted a nominating process more favorable to his opponent, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli. The third annual RVA Environmental Film Festival will go green screen at the Bird Theater this weekend. The two-day movie festival will once again showcase movies that address environmental issues impacting Richmond and the world. Included this year are films such as Chasing Ice, which shows global warming in deadly detail, and Vegetated, a movie about the importance of eating your broccoli. All screenings on Saturday and Sunday are free and open to the public, and you can log on to rvaenvironmentalfilmfestival.com for a full schedule and more information.
Play within a play is a common theatrical device. Shakespeare's tragic drama Hamlet famously uses the staging of a performance of The Murder of Gonzago in an effort to provoke guilty feelings in a certain murdering uncle. The Firehouse Theater Project hasn't staged any recent productions of Hamlet, but the current drama playing itself out offstage at the vaunted Contemporary Theater's Broad Street home might appeal as a classic story of betrayal if the Bard were still writing. And it's one that seems to have earned an extended run, though not because of positive audience response. In mid-December, the board of the Theater Project, comprising mostly new members, voted to force the retirement of founding member and artistic director Carol Pearsall. Pearsall, rather than play along with the role the board attempted to write for her, resigned immediately. That unleashed a firestorm in the Richmond theater community, pitting actors against actors, and Pearsall against the board's leadership, President Kay Holmes and Vice President Joe Kennedy. With some patrons running for the exits, there are very real questions now about the future of the theater. I'm with Carol Pearsall, the former artistic director of the Firehouse Theater Project, Harry Kolatz Jr., and Don Baker, both former board members of the Firehouse Theater Project. Thank you guys for joining me.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks.
And I guess what we'll start with is if I'd very much like to talk a little bit about the history of the theater. You guys started how many years ago?
1993.
October 1993.
And how did this come about?
You know, we were all in, some of us were in acting classes together. Harry, we all took classes from Janet Wilson. And we were performing some things from the acting class at places like Coffee and Company in Carrytown.
Which is where I saw it for the first time, where I saw this the Meisner method employed.
Right. So you guys are doing this at this coffee shop and other places around town and decided one day, hey, let's
start a theater. And so we were with some other people who hadn't been in the class. There were probably about 8 people at the meeting that day.
Yeah, it was Anna Seneschal, now Anna Seneschal Johnson, and Bill Gordon, whom I met doing theater at the Carillon in Harold Pinter's Betrayal. I was Jerry the Cat in that show. Anyway, and so that's how I ended up meeting Carol and Janet. And we started the experiment together around Carol and Maury's kitchen table, which is still there.
But we said, well, if we start a theater, we want to have something specific. We don't want to just have anything. And some people wanted to do a variety of works, classics and modern, different things. We wanted to do contemporary American theater and rehearse based on Meisner.
We looked at the landscape, the theater landscape in Richmond, and there really wasn't any one theater doing what we proposed to do, and that was contemporary theater written in the United States. And also combining that with older, perhaps somewhat older classical works, very new contemporary right off Broadway, and original works.
And some of them right off the typewriter.
Right? Some of them hot fresh right out of the typewriter, yeah, exactly.
And at that time, Richmond was sort of censored. That other groups were not doing anything with swear words, and we wanted to do Mamet, and you couldn't do it in certain theaters in Richmond. So we wanted to go there.
So where did you go to do there?
Well, we had, first of all, some of the people dropped out, but Anna Seneschal, Bill Gordon, Harry Kolatz, myself, and Janet Wilson, the 5 of us that agreed on that's what we wanted to do. Then we knew that we wanted to have a space because we said the production company had just closed. It was a really good group in Richmond, and it didn't make it because they were going from space to space to space, and they'd have a show ready, nowhere to do it. We said, we're not going to do this unless we have a building.
It's wearying. It's tough enough producing theater, but to have to do it in different locations, unless that's your focus, unless you're doing, driving around neighborhoods in the back of trucks,
right,
and that's your raison d'etre or raison theater. For Richmond-ness, too, it's good just to have a place that people can go to, know what they're going to get when they get there.
We're a city of habits, for sure.
We are a city of habits.
Nowhere to park.
So that was a big part of that.
How did you find this building?
We looked all over the place. We looked downtown. We looked
Chaco.
At different buildings, and we were looking for 18-foot ceilings, at least. And Bev and Al Lacey were at the old Davis and Main one night and said, you should look at the firehouse. They're building a new firehouse on Hermitage, and that's going to be empty. So we went over to the fire station, and I talked to the firemen, and they said, yeah, we're moving. We're moving out pretty soon.
So they were still in the building?
They were still in the building the first time I went in there. Yeah, the fire engines were there, and it was just right. And Bill Gordon worked for RVA at the time.
WRVA.
And he...
when they had a news
He
program.
Used to cover City Hall and cover all the city council meetings. So he called up Bob and asked him if we could use it for a fundraiser. And he said, okay, if you can get insurance. So we had to raise $2,000, and Patricia Cornwall was on our board at the time. We formed a board in the meantime. So they moved out. We scrubbed the oil off the cement, and we set up chairs, and we did a fundraiser.
And you got Harry off the pole.
And after that, we would just ask them from time to time. We said, we want to do another show. In the meantime, they were parking ambulances there, so they'd say okay, and they'd move the ambulances out.
Well, the health bus, the WIC bus, they'd park it there.
And then we'd build another stage and do another show, and finally we told them they couldn't use it anymore to park in.
But the city had to, since
the city owned it.
Yeah, the building was vacated, so they kept the water running to keep the pipes from freezing, and they kept the lights, the electricity going, because they needed to store things there. So I got in the habit of saying that we are the cheapest arts organization, least expensive arts organization the city never funded.
But in a way, they I guess they kind of did.
They did, in a way.
Yeah, we never paid a penny.
So now you're able to, at some point, obviously purchase the building. And that was a big deal for the Firehouse Theater. Now you have a home, and you moved forward.
Well, in 98, the spring of 98, when that became an issue, it was basically the city wanted to put the building back on the tax rolls. And they gave us, at one point, 90 days to raise $80,000. And I was on the stage every night of the run of Four Dogs and a Bone, John Patrick Shanley play, and exhorting people to give money because it was the only way we were going to stay there. And then during that run of that show, during the intermission, I was approached by a man I had no idea who he was. And he said, "Harry, how's that fundraising going?" And I said, "Well, you know, someone could walk through that door and change everything." And he said, "I'll buy the building for you." And that's...
And his name was
Roy Sutton and Barbara Sutton.
Yay, Roy.
Roy and Barbara.
Yeah.
And they bequeathed the building, though, to the
Ultimately,
foundation.
Ultimately, yes.
The deal was he bought the building and he let us use it. We paid, I think, $400 a month for his interest payment. And...
cheaper than some college kids.
Yeah, $80,000, and he said we could buy it from him within 10 years for this, and he'd freeze the price.
Wow.
So then when the 10 years was almost up, he donated it.
It was around about Christmas time, what, 4 years ago at least? Yeah. A great Christmas present.
That is a great Christmas present.
Yeah,
I bet everybody was smiling. So that's Christmas 4 years ago.
Yeah, about that.
And
four years later.
You were moving along with it. In fact, actually, it's a surprise, such a surprise that it's hard to sort of walk into the story of how it happened. There doesn't seem to have been anything leading up to it.
Well, I can tell you, as a Johnny come lately to this place, I started going to the Firehouse probably in 99 or 2000. And the first reaction I had, which so many other people have had, is this Richmond? Because it was not only plays that weren't being done, but wouldn't be done in Richmond, and beyond that, they were done with such a level of professionalism that it was just, you know, I've been going to Theater Virginia since I moved here, and they had wonderful facilities and a big audience and a lot of money, and they couldn't hold a candle to what the Firehouse was and has been doing over the years.
4 years elapse. You've got some level of comfort or semi-comfort. There's a semi-annual financial crisis, but other than that, you're moving along as a theater.
And in the black, too, for the most part.
And also really, I mean, gaining a great deal of, I think, notoriety and respect in the community. Did you see any hints of this coming, Carol?
No. Not
without a penny of debt.
No debt whatsoever. The last year, we were in the middle of the run of Death of a Salesman that had been extended and was critically acclaimed. We'd done Rocky Horror in the summer, extended, sold out.
And that was, as I recall, pretty much huge.
Huge. Made a lot of money. And before that, Death of Rose, which was gigantic. We extended that. Earlier, Cat in a Hot Tin Roof. I also had all these projects from now until the rest of the year. We were going to be doing this Breston show that was a play in development, so it was only the second.
We'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit.
It was the second production being done. We have an annual Festival of New American Plays, and that's a contest. We were in the middle of it. We had the best plays ever. And we were in the middle of choosing the winner. We were
hundreds of entrants from all over the United States.
I was going to say, my understanding is this has really become...
It's huge.
Something rather big.
Yeah,
nationwide.
I get agents that send plays. And we were supposed to announce the winner February 1st. And I don't know where it stands. But we were also going to do a full production of last year's winner in May of Nureyev's Eyes, which has just been published... And it was in American Theater Magazine, a story about it. And we were about to do the first full production in the country of that play.
And just to back up for a minute, the reputation of the theater was spreading much beyond Richmond. And the great, famous Edward Albee, the playwright,
mm-hmm.
came down here to do one of his shows. The playwright Israel Horowitz has become a personal friend of Carol's, and he comes down and previews all his new shows there. So this, you know, this was a real deal.
So Richmond had something on the map, finally, in theater.
Yeah, and we're mentioned in American Theater Magazine various times. Kyle Jarrow and Clay Chapman, two young, hip playwrights, come to Richmond. We do their work.
Now, there had been some changes in the management at the Firehouse recently. Mm-hmm. There was, as I understand, maybe a retreat at which point there was something that came out of this retreat that we need to separate the artistic from the management side and to allow the artistic director to do more of the artistic direction, and we'll bring in this somebody to do management.
Yeah, that's what we always wanted. We just couldn't afford to do it because it had gotten so huge I couldn't handle both jobs anymore. So I went to Philadelphia a year ago and asked the Carpenter Foundation to fund a managing director so that I could be free to concentrate on the artistic.
And they
did.
So you brought in this managing director position.
Right.
And so now they're bringing this person. There were some conflicts, or
the person that they hired. Yeah, there were a lot of conflicts.
I think one of the problems that happened here is that when Harry and I and others were on the board, actually we term limited ourselves to 6 years, but when we came on the board, we already had an interest and a presence in the theater. And what's happened lately, as best as I can tell, is a group of people who have come onto the board, some of whom I don't think ever had seen a show at the Firehouse. They were using kind of a old girls network to bring in their friends, and there was virtually no institutional memory.
So in my looking at the issue, it seems like a lot of that old girl network that was coming in, as you put it, some of it was that the theater, because of its reputation in the community and elsewhere, it had become something of a stamp of importance to be on this board.
I think in some people's eyes it was established but edgy enough so that it seemed like they were still hip in a way, or relevant. And that's what I sort of got from some of their participation. Well, the other thing is nonprofits in their life cycles have to figure out a way to stabilize themselves and get firm financial legs under. We were financially in a good place, and we wanted to expand on that. We wanted to build on what we had constructed, build on our framework. And we thought that we were bringing into service, into the board, people whose interests were in line with our own.
Plus, I was working on the partnerships with Center Stage, with the Modlin Center. I mean, that was going to be huge, and it was going to be a huge financial gain to the Firehouse to have the Modlin Center be a partner.
And certainly you could see where that would be to their benefit as well. They now have this contemporary theater company that has partnered with them that's doing things that are...
Right, yeah. Well, we already started a film series with them that's going on all year, and we were planning on partnering in the summer with a show, we were working on bringing out of town like performance art, and maybe some of it would be at the Firehouse, some of it at the Modlin Center in their subscription series. We brought in Z from London, and
which got a lot of attention in town. I think not just because of this drama, the exterior drama, but because of it being a notable drama.
The story
it was incredible,
yeah.
and it did very well. But you know, we would have the entire Modlin Center mailing list would go out for these things. So that's gigantic, and that those kind of people like the theater we do, but they haven't been there.
And I'd probably anger my engineer Jay if I didn't mention that you also had the listening room, which apparently had started to get
amazing. Amazing.
And this was apparently a stop-off for a lot of touring musicians.
And the musicians liked the space. I went many times, and the musicians liked the acoustics of the building, and they liked the fact that the audience was there to listen. Many of these people were accustomed to playing in crowded bars or venues that weren't really conducive to their kind of quieter, softer, more intense music.
This was like doing VH1 Unplugged or MTV
exactly.
Unplugged.
That's exactly what it was like. And the musicians really responded to that. And it was some powerful music played there. I mean, some really incredible players. And I don't know where that is now. And in addition, it was used by the community. The neighborhood associations came there and met. And other organizations throughout the city, because of our locality, because of parking across the street that was allowed to us, people knew where it was. It was identifiable, and people liked the place.
It was a magical place. It was, you walked in and just felt the positive vibes. And we did readers' theaters, and we had young people come, and I would let somebody would come and say, "Can we do a performance piece of VCU group?" And I'd say, "Sure," and we'd figure out, and we just split the door and make sure we covered our expenses. But on a weeknight, we would let them do shows on a set of a play that was running, and we'd try to accommodate all kinds of artists.
Just to have it happen.
Yeah.
What's so perplexing about the board's actions is that, there were two people who were kind of the driving forces of the board, as best as I can tell, both very strong personalities. Neither had been with the theater more than 2 years, well, maybe much less than that.
And this is, of course, the president, Kay Holmes.
Right, Kay Holmes and Joe Kennedy. And they looked around and made an assessment that there was a problem at the firehouse, and then proceeded to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Now, the problem, has there been any indication of what the problem was?
Nothing substantial that, some really strange things like Jeannie put combination locks on the doors.
That's the managing director,
and instead of me using the combination, I broke the lock off.
did you do that? You seem small to break the lock off.
Even
of the
though
door.
I couldn't even do it. I had the combo had a kink in it, and it wouldn't open. And several people tried to. And my acting class was coming up the stairs, so I called my husband to bring a crowbar over and open it so I could have acting class. But I didn't. But that was actually read at a board meeting that Jeannie gave everybody combos, but Carol broke the lock off instead of using the combo.
Oh, okay.
Well, I had conversations with both Joe and Kay about what were the substantive problems with Carol. Name some. And the best they could come up with was, well, one time Carol took a check and went out to Costco and bought some supplies because they needed to be bought instead of going to the person who should have gone but wasn't there. And another time, Carol was...
Were there big controls on purchases like that with the use of the checkbook?
No, I didn't actually go to Costco, but Amy, our producer, went. And so she came, I signed the check, which I have signed privileges, and that's the way we always did it for years and years and years.
So Amy went,
she got the bottled water and the M&Ms and put the receipt in the bookkeeper's mailbox.
One time Carol was a half hour late for a meeting, even though she told them she was going to be a half hour late.
I was teaching a class.
So there was some questionable in
Yeah, it's like the people who want to impose a business model on the government. I mean, it sounds good, but it doesn't work, and I don't think a very strict business model works with an arts organization.
God forbid that artists should run arts organizations, you know.
So you were told in a rather interesting way that you were not going to be with the theater anymore. What I found when I was reporting this out was that you got a phone call from a former president of the
mm-hmm.
board telling
yeah,
you
the
that,
past president.
That you were going to be asked to resign, and then there was some sort of a back and forth between your husband, Mari, and this past president. And he clarified and said, no, she's been fired.
Right. I asked him that. He said, no. I said, well, is this what's going on? And he said, they want you to retire by June 30th. And I said, you mean I'm being fired? And he said, yes. And then my husband asked to have what they want in writing.
In writing, okay. And that's what they sent you. And now they've said since then that they had intention to keep you on somehow in a possibly even a paid position, but that was not in any of that.
No.
And seems counter to you're fired.
There was no mention of me staying. In fact, they said I could leave tomorrow if I wanted and be paid through the 30th.
And in fact, that's in that email that's on our, I think it's on our website.
Right.
You decided that you were not going to sit back and play the game till June. Mm-mm. You went ahead and resigned?
Right. Yeah. I couldn't pretend.
And you put out a statement to that effect that this was not something you could do.
No, I couldn't possibly go in there and pretend to the patrons and donors and actors that I had decided suddenly to retire. It would be false.
Now, when we spoke, you had said that you did have some plans to retire soon, in the next 4 or 5 years? Or
well, maybe 5 years, yeah.
But it was not something that the board was really discussing
in
any concrete way at this point. It came up very quickly.
Well, they must have been discussing it, but not with me.
Well, I mean, in talking with former board members who have resigned as a result of this, it didn't sound like there was much discussion of any sort of sudden transition to away from the direction that they were going.
Probably not in front of the whole board, but in the...
It does sound like it was a railroad job, even with the board. Oh, I know one member who said she thought that she was voting on a proposal for Carol's retirement, which she thought Carol had requested. Didn't know until the...
So there, I had not heard anything like that. That much confusion on this board during this meeting, where they thought even that it was something that Carol had herself requested.
Right.
And there was, I guess, a reading. This is now almost kind of legendary in the theater. There's a reading, a dramatic reading by Joe Kennedy of this email that she had penned and sent to the executive board, in which she demanded that you be gone before she came on as president. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard that from several board members that were there.
Did you have a bad relationship with her? Was there any sort of...
I brought her on the board. She was a friend of mine. I'd been on committees for her at the Visual Arts Center.
So you recruited her to the board?
Yes.
Well, I think Joe Kennedy, you know, she was the head of the hand workshop of the Visual Arts Center. She has very specific ideas, obviously, of the way an organization ought to be run, and I remember reading recently that when she was at the Visual Arts Center, and she was responsible for the name change, which I certainly agreed with, that she was complaining, if that's the right word, that the bylaws required that three artists had to be on the board. So, you know, that sounds like not a strange thing, that artists would be on the board of an art center, and actors might be on the board of a playhouse, but not if you're running a corporation. I don't think we want to make suggestions about their motives. They have managed to do some innuendo and gossip about Carol.
Well, there's
Carol.
This talk of a tier one theater, I guess, is that the effort is to make it into a tier one theater.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means. I do think that there are so many people supporting Carol that it's too early to pronounce the death of the firehouse. I think that
I'm
hopeful that cooler heads will prevail. There can be some kind of a reconciliation and
a rapprochement,
which can only happen, I think, if Carol is restored fully to her position. But there may be some other ways that they can be satisfied that it's going to be more of a business model.
Now, Carol, could you go back, do you think?
I could go back if things were different.
How would they have to be different?
They'd have to be different people around.
Meaning the board? Could the board, some of the board stay? Could you negotiate with this current board?
Oh, some of the board definitely could stay. I think that some of the board have been misled, and I think when they realize that, they might do the right thing. And
I do think that it's smart, though, for those of us who are trying to get Carol back, not to play all of our cards and not to make statements that might impair this coming about.
And you are still negotiating with them.
Yes.
Have you been in regular talks with them recently, or is anybody acting as an intermediary at this point for you?
Yeah, I've got an attorney who talks to their attorney in terms of...
Well, that sounds close.
In terms of just making proposals. Okay. Because I've found that the talk doesn't come through. So we've gotten written proposals.
Now, you have had some one-to-one conversations with board members.
Not since December. Not for a long time. I haven't.
Okay.
No.
So like late December or early January was a...
December, I think, was the last time I talked. It was Hester Lewis who came over and asked if I would come and be part of the 20th anniversary and be emeritus, and I said no.
That would be kind of difficult under the circumstances, or?
Yeah. They weren't offering me any job or any money. It was just come
now,
back.
The building itself, Harry had mentioned the thought that there might be some interest in the building.
Well, I don't want to, I don't know. I frankly don't know what's going on. All I know is they are trying to get this one show done. I just don't know. I think it's going to be difficult for them to continue running it as a going concern theater, given the present circumstances.
I like to think of it as, in Super Bowl terms, of which team has what. The current operators of the firehouse have a building, seats, lights, and some money. We have Carol.
So you've got the heart.
Plus the actors and the
directors. And the community. I mean, the theater community.
And the patrons and the grants. So
the foundations, yeah.
And you've talked with some, I'm assuming, people outside of the Richmond area. How does this damage, or does it damage, this theater's reputation outside of here? Again, you were saying this is a theater that's become something of a known theater outside of Richmond. It's a magnet for playwrights and well-known playwrights. How do you recover that if we can put the pieces back together?
If I came back, it would have to be different people so that you can go to you can prove that things are different. There's so much damage that's been done.
What sort of damage does this do, something like this?
We've had donors who haven't donated. We've had season subscribers who've gotten refunds for the rest of the season. Foundations aren't going to want to touch the place because it looks so bad.
People who give substantial sums of money don't like to see drama.
Except on stage.
Except on stage. I mean, I think realistically you expect some backstage drama, but you want it kept out of the papers, off of blogs, out of the public eye. This has been watching a cultural China syndrome, basically. Almost every other day, something. And it's kind of causes people to clench up and say, whoa, I don't think I want to give money.
I really would like to ask you, Carol, now that you're in the middle of this, this is something we've seen a lot of, it seems like, in recent years with people who are talent in this city, who create things, are creators, being pushed out of the thing that they created. What is it with Richmond that we would do this to these people that, like you, who have become institutions? Yourself, of course, you've also got Lisa Toronto with Tricycle Gardens was pushed out. Maylily Lee was another interesting one that's a TV personality, but still, I mean, she had created sort of this institution that was Virginia Currents. And certainly around town, we've had a number of others in recent years. Do you have any thoughts now that you, I guess, have become one of those people as to what it is that Richmond has against its creative class?
Unless people see something successful and they want to grab it, And they know that they can't have control if that person is still there.
Which seems a strange and counterintuitive modus of operation, because if this person has helped create this thing and make it what it is, why wouldn't you want to keep that person around?
Were you
unless you feel threatened somehow.
Did you have a tight control on this theater? I mean, was it tightly reined theater while you were there? Or
what?
In other words, did you hold the reins tight, or were you more of a loose leader? How did you work inside of the theater? Would you have been considered somebody who was a Napoleon, I guess, in
no,
the position?
No, I was.
Carol's modest.
We had Lisa Catula was the bookkeeper, so she was spot on, and it was everything was.
The day-to-day.
Day-to-day was running.
It functioned.
Functional. It was. Yeah.
Phones got answered.
You know,
reservations got made.
It's no different than all the other theaters in
the
town.
The proof is that every year the number of season subscribers went up.
Yep. Yes.
The budget went up. The facilities were improved.
Every year, yes. I just finished a $100,000 capital campaign that I did with Margie Gilbert before she left.
And presumably this was a successful capital campaign.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. So the theater was very much in the black.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
So where do you go now? I guess you have taken one of the productions and are doing it as a fundraiser.
It's a show.
It's a show, but yeah. to pay for the actors who were supposed to be performing here at the firehouse.
No, this is just doing the show that was supposed to be done at the firehouse. So this is a play about a musical about breast cancer, and we're performing it 6 performances, and we're helping the playwrights, and the person who conceived of it is going to bring people here from out of town, and she's trying to get it produced in other places.
So this is the first time for this production?
It was done once in Connecticut at a JCC, so this is the second production.
And how much do you need with your fundraising efforts before?
Well, I think it's going to be, the budget's $15,000 for the show. We will have ticket sales. It's just that without a theater, we have no theater. So I'm going out on a limb here because I'm signing contracts with these actors and I don't have a job, and now it's I'm going to be responsible for making sure that everybody gets paid.
Again, Carol Pearsall, the former artistic director of the Firehouse Theater Project, Harry Kollatz Jr., and Don Baker, both former board members, and I guess almost, are you still emeritus? Somewhat.
As long as we're breathing.
Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
The acclaimed new compilation CD, Pop Ye Ye, may be the first and last word on Malaysian and Singapore-based rock and roll, but it has a big Richmond connection. The recently released disc is the brainchild of local archivist and DJ Carl Ham, who instituted a Kickstarter campaign to help explore what happened when the Southeast Asian region discovered and reacted to the Beatles in the mid to late 60s. You'll know Carl's voice from his Sunday night music program up here at WRIR called If Music Could Talk, where he regularly spins key Malaysian rock pioneers such as M. Osman and Rozia Latif and the Jayhawkers. Or perhaps you know him as DJ Carlito and have been a part of his popular Bollywood events around town. Pop Ye Ye features not only a wealth of little heard music, undocumented in the West, it features Ham's meticulous and well-researched liner notes. The disc is available now on the Sublime Frequencies label, and we welcome Carl Ham to the program today. Congrats, Carl.
Thank you very much, Don. We should also say that Carl is a member of the board of the Virginia Center for the Public Press, the nonprofit group that administers WRIR. Got to get that in there.
That's correct.
Talk to me a little bit about, well, first of all, tell me a little about your background and when you first started getting into music, kind of a music nut.
Well, I've always been kind of a musical child since when I was very young. Even my parents had a record collection, and one of those records was the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. Mm. And we also had all kinds of different classical records laying around, and some strange kind of electronic versions of classical music that were kind of popular back in the 70s. Like,
yeah, the Beatles on the Moog.
And yeah, kind of yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I got a good dose of the 60s and 70s, conservative dose of the 60s and 70s through my artistic parents, one of them being a painting professor at VCU at the time, and then my mother, that was my father, and then my mother having worked at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. So I was exposed to not only art and music, but also international culture through those through VCU and through the Virginia Museum. And you know, then later on, of course, I would have to credit my sister as being the person who opened a lot of the doors for me for music. Being an older sister, several years older than me, she was making mixtapes of punk rock on one side of a cassette, and then she'd put like Pakistani Qawwalis on the other side, or
wow,
or interspersed the two of them throughout the cassettes. And
now, where was she getting these influences?
Well, she had a lot of different friends with a lot of really crazy record collections. People like, well, just all kinds of different punk rockers that she was sharing apartments with. So she would dig through their collections, and she had her own collection. And then I later inherited her collection when she moved out west. But even after she moved out to San Francisco, she was sending me mixtapes of Cuban music and salsa and various other stuff. So, yeah, my sister hipped me to a lot of cool stuff, too, over the years.
Right. So you grew up listening to a varied range. When did you first get exposed to the rock and roll of Malaysia and Singapore?
Well, I'm after college, after studying music recording, I moved back here for a year and then moved up to New York and then, you know, explored a whole bunch of other cultural, you know, styles of music and culture in New York, which is a great place to explore that stuff. Then moved back here and was working at a coffee shop that's no longer there, but Cafe Gutenberg down in Shaco Bottom. And that's where I ran into Bill Lupoletti for the first time.
He
told me, hey, you know, we got this radio station we're trying to start up. There's a meeting next week if you want to come. And so I joined up, and we weren't on the air yet, but I stuck with it, and then we finally got the license. I got my show, and then from there I was faced with the task of putting together a fun and exciting and inspiring radio show every week. So I was just as I was beginning to branch out into different genres for that show, If Music Could Talk, I figured, you know, why don't I try to explore some of Southeast Asia beyond the Bollywood that I already knew about. I already had a little knowledge of Cambodian music because there was a Cambodian market I used to shop at over on the south side, but didn't know much about Indonesian music or Malaysian music. And both of those countries are so close, and the tsunami had happened just right around that time. I was like, I really want to know more about the culture of Indonesia. They had this horrible earthquake and tsunami, and maybe I'll try to find some Indonesian websites and figure out something about the culture. So I was initially buying what I thought was Indonesian music on eBay, and it ended up that some of the records were actually Malaysian and Singaporean artists. So accidentally, you know, through trying to find more diverse selection to share with people on my show, came upon this Singaporean and Malaysian rock. As I kind of hit this sort of pocket of time, which is now on this compilation being designated between 1964 and 1970, I realized there was a specific sound to it, and a lot of these albums were being pressed on very small labels. So when I started collecting them, and again, all through eBay, They were relatively cheap. I could afford to buy a couple of them every month and mm-hmm. get them shipped over. But since then, the prices keep going up more and more and more. As you know, through boxes full of EPs, you know, there's all kinds of just amazing graphics and photos on the EPs themselves. A lot of times, you know, that's part of what drew me to it in the first place, was just these fantastic, colorful covers mm-hmm. on these EPs. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, you know, the Kickstarter trip, going to Malaysia and Singapore, and then finally meeting up with the artists, they gave me access to some of their own personal photo collections. So those photos, personal photos of the artists, as well as EP covers, mm-hmm. made it into the liner notes of this CD.
Let's go back a little bit. When you mentioned the Kickstarter campaign. That was specifically to go over to Malaysia and find out more about this music. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So somewhere along the line, my EP collection, my record collection of Malaysian music reached critical mass, and I pitched this idea to Sublime Frequencies. Hey, why don't you guys let me help you put together a compilation for your label, since you guys are doing all these other countries, Indonesia in particular. Why don't we do a Malaysian and Singaporean compilation? And Alan Bishop of Sublime Frequencies said, yeah, let's do it. And so we started that rolling, and then
because they've done a number of these international rock projects before.
That's right. They've focused on Cambodia, Indonesia, Thailand.
Right.
There's all kinds of great stuff on that label, and also parts of Africa. I mean, there's just all kinds mm-hmm. of really strange.
It shows you through their work and others and yours. It shows you just how far-reaching rock and roll really was.
Yeah,
especially in the 60s.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, halfway through compiling or curating this compilation idea, before it even, you know, really got going, I sort of hit a ideological roadblock with my own self that, you know, I know a lot of times compilations have been put out without a lot of interaction with the actual artists, you mm-hmm, know, people, mm-hmm. Hey, I found it. I'm going to put it out.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Right.
If someone doesn't like it, they can yeah. write to me later. Yeah.
They're probably dead anyway, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah. Yeah.
Yeah. And they'd probably love it if I did it anyway.
Yeah.
And you know, it probably would have been okay if I had gone that route. I don't know. I've got a conscience that just wouldn't let me sleep without actually going the extra mile and trying to find the artist. So that's really what happened. I put the brakes on. I said, you know, even though we probably could do this, I want to go over and make the effort to find the artists
right.
and get their blessing to do this and also get the information right from their own heads and their own memories about what this scene was about. So the Kickstarter, coming back to your mm-hmm, original mm-hmm. question, was Kickstarter project was a way for me to fund my trip over there to find the artists, get their permission to make the CD, release it on Sublime Frequencies, get their permission and find out more about what the scene was all about.
Right, right.
And also work on a documentary, which is still in progress.
So you were filming too while you were over there?
I filmed every single interview I did. I did a total of 19 different interviews with all these different
artists.
Wow,
okay. Give me some examples of some of the musicians that are on the compilation, some of the musicians you met and talked with.
Well, one of the important people that I met, and was a real point to meet up with this guy when I first was scheduling my trip and all that, I landed in Singapore, and like maybe a day later, I had a meeting with this guy, Yuznor F., who was a lyricist for a lot of different artists in the 70s, not the 60s. But he was able to put me in touch with one of the guys who represents one of the labels that a lot of these artists ended up on later
mm-hmm,
on.
Mm-hmm.
And then two of the artists who were from this era, who was Zamzam was one of them, and M. Ishak was another. Neither of those guys, unfortunately, appear on this compilation, but maybe in the future.
But they could kind of help you fill out the scene, what was going on.
Yeah, those were my first two interviews, and I interviewed them at a street side basically a Malaysian noodle shack kind of place, amazing place in Singapore. And after interviewing both of those guys, at the end of the conversation, we were having some this type of traditional tea called teh tarik, drinking tea and talking. And Yuznarev turns to the label guy, and they're talking about Anita Sarawak, who's, like, in my opinion, I guess, sort of one of the biggest pop singers of the 70s of Malaysia and Singapore, kind of on the scale of like Cher, maybe, and that same kind of glamour.
Yeah.
She was having an album release tour, the very album release show concert in Malaysia the very next day. And they're like, well, you got to get up there because there's going to be all these pop yay yay artists at that show too. And that'll be your good chance to meet up with them. So I get on a bus the very early the next morning and get up there, drop my bags off at a hotel, run over to the concert venue. I'm like, I haven't showered. I'm looking like really haggard. And I roll into this place and sit down right as she's starting up her first song. And I happen to be sitting right next to Adnan Othman. Just, you know, and and my friend who was going to meet up with me there, he's like, yeah, that's Adnan Othman right there. He's the first artist who appears on this compilation. And after the intermission, he turned to me. He's like, hi, Carl. Very nice to meet you. Idol has told me all about you. And I know why you're here. Right. And I want to help you. Come to my house tomorrow for dinner. And by the way, here's a manila folder full of addresses and phone numbers of all the artists you're trying to find.
Oh, my gosh.
So from there, this guy was like, you know, my
your angel.
Guardian angel. And he introduced me to another real key player who was Dato A. Rahman Hassan and his wife, Datin Aziza Muhammad, who together are the two main vocalists for the longest running pop yeye band ever. They're still together after 40 plus years now. So between Adnan Othman and Dato A. Rahman Hassan and his wife, they sort of introduced me to everyone else and and toured me around Malaysia also and showed me where I needed to go.
You'd mentioned that this style of music was only really around for a couple of years. Describe it. What is this music like? Is it a straight up sort of mirroring of American rock and roll styles?
Well,
and British rock and roll styles?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah, it's more accurate to say British because Malaysia and Singapore were actually until somewhere in 1960 something. It says in the liner notes here, and I'm looking for the exact date. They split. So Singapore split off from Malaysia during a period where they were trying to sort of unify all the different states of Malaysia. But what happened is basically so Great Britain sort of granted Malaysia independence in the late 50s. I think it was 1957. And after that, Malaysia went through this sort of identity crisis, and they were still, I think, in my opinion, sort of there was a lot of British radio, British music being played on the radio. It was, you know, the end of...
They'd kind of been in that culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether they liked it or not, they were there.
It was a British colony, and for many years it was. And so that British influence lingered on for many, many years up until this day. And so that, you know, the Beatles, Cliff Richard, very important figure,
Cliff Richard and the Shadows.
And the Shadows and the Beatles, two really important British bands. And then there's the Rolling Stones, of course, and others. But those were all being heard on the radio and also in like little tea shops where, you know, if you couldn't afford if you couldn't afford a record player, you'd go to the tea shop and hear the jukebox, and you'd play the Beatles or Cliff Richard on the jukebox. So kids were listening
sort
to
this
stuff.
Sort of like their version of us going to the hamburger joint.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. At the Hop.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, kids were being immersed in this music, and at some point, I think it just sort of, you know, it was like that was the thing to do, is to start up a band and throw a little house parties and play music. But somewhere along the line, you know, there was a lot of mimicry and a lot of adaptation of Western sounds. But then, so it was, to answer your question, it wasn't a direct copy. It was an adaptation. So there's a lot of Malay melodies, mm-hmm. a lot of lyrical thematic content that relates to Malay culture and what it was like.
And a lot of surfy, you know, kind of surfy guitar. And
well, the thing about surf music that I've always liked is that there's always been that sort of Middle Eastern sound to surf music. You know, the song Miserlou, that's like an ancient Greek song that's been done by Israeli singer, Israeli artist.
You're trying to evoke the Polynesian feel.
And Arabic. I'm getting off track here. But basically, like, surf music, I think, really lends itself well to the Malay melodic structures.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been talking to Carl Hamm, a.k.a. DJ Carlito. The disc jockey and musical archivist is the spark plug behind a new compilation disc of Malaysian rock and roll called Pop Ye Ye. The disc is available now on the Sublime Frequencies label, and you can hear Carl every Sunday, often playing some of this very music, on WRIR at 7 p.m. for If Music Could Talk. Thanks for coming in, Carl.
Thank you, Don.
Congratulations again.
Thanks a lot.
And that's our show for February 8th, 2013. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and our board op today is the lovely Manion. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to build the world's first bionic man. Mike McKenzie will be that man. Better, stronger, faster. Did you know that our website at rvaopensource.com is on the World Wide Web? That's where you'll find breaking news, links to show podcasts, and more information on our interview subjects. And we want to send a special congratulations to Jay Westerman, our co-producer and WRIR's Volunteer of the Year. Good job, Jay. The gold watch is in the mail. So until next week, thanks for listening to Open Source RVA. Yeah, I know.